Google CEO Sundar Pichai facing the heat Tuesday on Capitol Hill. Members of the House Judiciary Committee Tuesday pushed Pichai to explain Google's data privacy and collection policies, protections to stop its YouTube service from being used to spread violence, hate speech, misinformation, and attempts to sway elections. Pichai also taken to task again and again by conservatives who see Google search results as biased against them.
A Munich, Germany gold dealer has created what it calls Europe's most expensive Christmas tree. Dealer Pro Arum and the Austrian Mint partnered to create this very festive holiday showstopper. It's made out of 2018 1 ounce Vienna Philharmonic gold coins, each resting in their own slot on an acrylic tree. At current trading prices, the tree and its star are worth about $2.6 million. Now, that would have been more had the price of gold not fallen 5% this year.
Time magazine has named four journalists and one news organization as its 2018 Person of the Year. They will be featured on four different covers. Time says the group was chosen for, quote, taking great risks in pursuit of greater truths, for the imperfect but essential quest for facts that are central to civil discourse, for speaking up and speaking out.
WGN Radio's Daily Conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Wednesday. It's December 12th, 5:10 in the morning. We are back at it with another edition of The Opening Bell and another business day getting underway. And we appreciate you tuning in today for the broadcast, and we've put together a good one for you. We're going to talk about the future of food. Matt Carmichael is here, the editor at Gen Pop. We're going to talk about their latest quarterly report on what the future, the WTF, focusing on food. Good conversation, we promise, coming up with Matt in just a few seconds here. A little bit later in the program, John Boyd will be here. He's the CEO of Klein and Hoffman. And we're going to be talking about preserving Chicago's architectural integrity while updating the old parts of the city. We'll have him in our second segment this morning at about 5:40. So a conversation about the business of architecture and historic preservation a little bit later on. But first, let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk with futures pointing toward opening gains later on Wall Street. Futures showing right now up 183 points on the Dow. That's nearly 0.75%. S&P futures are right there with the Dow, up about 0.75%. NASDAQ futures are up over 1% this morning. Around the globe, markets are generally higher in Europe, with the FTSE in London up nearly 1%, the DAX in Germany up 1%, and the CAC in France up 1.5%. In Asia, markets are also in the green, with the Nikkei ending the day up about 2%. 454 points. The Hang Seng is up 1.5%, and the Shanghai is going to finish up about 1/3. Oil this morning trading at $52.59 a barrel, which is up almost a full dollar. A couple of stories before we begin this morning. First of all, the opening bell will ring later this morning on Wall Street after stocks ended yesterday mixed at the close in a volatile trading session. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lower after swinging more than 500 points amid talk of a government shutdown. Stocks rose early in the session on signs that relations with China would be improving. The Dow ended up with a loss, though, of about 53 points, a wild ride yesterday on Wall Street. Today's big important economic reports include the Consumer Price Index for November. That'll lead off today's economic reports. Could move the markets today. You heard in the opening montage the discussion yesterday on Capitol Hill with the Google CEO, and news today also about Marriott. U.S. investigators zeroing in on Chinese state hackers as being the most likely culprits into last month's hack of Marriott's reservation system. That breach exposed the personal information of as many as 500 million guests. Media reports say the investigation is not complete, but the four-year intrusion shows signs of being done by the Chinese Ministry of State Security. They claim that this hack involved the same cloud hosting space that Chinese state hackers have used in the past. Another clue this was done by a nation is that no one is trying to sell the personal information, apparently not yet on the dark web. And Amazon now has a mini version of its Go store, the Amazon food store with no cashiers and no checkout lanes. has locations, of course, here in Chicago and in San Francisco and Seattle. Now Amazon has opened up a compact version of the Go store at the company's Seattle office. The mini Go store is only 450 square feet, will sell snacks and salads to office workers. Like other Go stores, customers will scan their smartphones to enter the store. Amazon will bill them as they leave. We begin front and center this morning with food in the future. The future of food bringing likely higher prices, more opposition to genetically modified food, and a population who thinks that they're at a healthy weight when they're probably not. It's all the results of the global study Ipsos and Genpop have been doing quarterly looks this year at all kinds of things, including health care, food, transportation, all sorts of things, consumer spending. And we're happy to have with us Matt Carmichael this morning, editor at GenPop, to talk a little bit about the latest installment of this on food. Matt, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. This is a good conversation. And by the way, we've loved to have these conversations all year with GenPop, with you guys, because this is, I think, anybody who's future thinking and forward thinking would enjoy each one of these quarterly reports delving into all kinds of good stuff. So we appreciate that. But let's talk about food today. What kinds of questions did you ask? What did you want to find out?
Yeah, as you mentioned, you know, this is a quarterly report. And kind of the setup is we go out and we talk to a lot of smart people in the space. So in this case, for food, we're talking to Rick Bayless, the celebrity chef from Frontera and Topolobampo. We're talking to people who are doing CRISPR gene editing. We're talking to executives at places like McDonald's and the Coca-Cola Company. And we, in addition to asking them questions and doing, you know, a pretty traditional interview with them about kind of how they see the future, we as Ipsos give them a question on our daily omnibus survey. We're in the field every day throughout the U.S. and many other countries. And we ask them, kind of looking into your crystal ball, what kind of questions do you think you're going to wish you had tracking data on in 5 or 10 years? In other words, what are the attitudes today that are going to shape the trends tomorrow? And by doing that, we kind of get them to open up a little bit and think a little bit more broadly about the future of their space. And we also start measuring consumer attitudes today. And so I think when you go back and you kind of look for an overall theme in this issue, it's all about changing definitions, that the terms we use every day to talk about food, things like meat and sweet and fast and convenient, all of these really bedrock issues are starting to shift. And we see that in the data today, and we certainly see that in the conversations about tomorrow.
And I want to get into a couple of different ones of these. And let's start first with the notion of, do we even need restaurants anymore going forward? I mentioned there in the opening of this broadcast the mini Go store from Amazon, but you know, we've also in Chicago have these Farmer's Fridge, where the we profiled the company recently. They have a vending machine that you can get salads and all kinds of fresh foods from. And the question you asked was, who needs restaurants? Is, and with delivery, that also has people talking about that in these home meal kits. Will restaurants go away in the future, or will there just be some sort of change as we move into the future of restaurants?
I think we see maybe a surprising amount of openness from people about, again, this changing definition of what even is a restaurant and what is, in the Farmer's Fridge example, what is a vending machine and what can a vending machine do? We actually profile Luke Saunders, the CEO and founder of Farmer's Fridge, in this issue, and he was, of course, curious about the future of vending machines. And as they start rolling out hot foods seem to be something that most people associated with something a restaurant can do better than a vending machine. But their vending machines, the Farmer's Fridges, are already very close to starting to roll out some hot items as well. And so can that sort of thing replace, you know, quick serve in your life? And I think the answer is probably, to some degree, yes. Certainly not entirely, and quick serve is working to come up with new ideas themselves. But between that and, as you mentioned, the Amazon Go stores, which are almost kind of like walk-in vending machines, right?
Right,
I mean,
yeah.
Kind of a similar scale, especially if they're doing smaller ones now. And you're seeing with companies like Uber Eats, where they're using excess capacity in restaurants to essentially create virtual restaurants that are delivery only. So I think that whole space is starting to shift and starting to redefine itself, and I think it's going to be interesting to see how that all shakes out in coming years.
Are we looking at a future where food is more expensive than it is now? I would guess the answer is yes to that, because it seems food climbs almost every year. At least most foods are, you know, rising with inflation. But how expensive will food be, do you think, in the future?
I mean, I don't want to project exactly how expensive, but the thing we saw, Ipsos did a 30-country study, and it looked at kind of people's outlook of the future of food. Like, will food be healthier? Will you have more access to options? And also, we asked about cost, and overall, the outlook was not all that positive. It wasn't a lot of people thinking that their access and their healthy foods would improve and get better. And I think partially that reflects that, for the most part, throughout the world, we have pretty good access to food. I mean, certainly not everybody, but overall, especially if you look at throughout history, we're in a pretty good place where it comes to food. But there was definitely a pretty high level of concern that the cost of all of these things is going to increase. I'm sure there are a number of different things driving that, but that is definitely the area of concern people have about the future of food. Is not about access, but it's about cost.
Matt Carmichael is with us this morning. He's the editor at Gen Pop. We're talking about the future of food. In addition to talking to Luke Saunders of Farmer's Fridge, you have the president of McDonald's on as well, talking about the future of restaurants, fast food, that is, and whether or not those delivery items, the delivery methods that we were talking about in the first segment, are going to impact the fast food culture. What did the president of McDonald's tell you?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, I think, definitely a concern for him, is that because of the changes in delivery and because of people's attitudes about delivery, and people are very, very into delivery and very enjoy the convenience of that, he is concerned that there could be new players in that space that who don't necessarily have a traditional retail restaurant footprint, brick-and-mortar restaurants that you can go to, but can create these kind of kitchens or use other kitchens, as Uber Eats is already kind of starting to do, to create virtual restaurants, and that, for the most part, consumers might not care so much whether it's an established brand they know or one of these new kind of concepts that could come up.
On the issue of food and production agriculture, people in agriculture will tell you that as we grow in population, we're not going to be able to avoid genetically modified food. But the opposition to that is still very strong, and will promises to be that way in the future. What are we setting ourselves up for with those two clashing with each other like that?
Well, I think it's an interesting issue, and as we kind of get into that both in our global survey, where we do see very strong opposition in certain parts of the world. It's actually a little less so in the U.S., and it's certainly stronger among older generations throughout the world and in the U.S. But as we get into the interviews later kind of within the magazine, we talked to Pamela Ronald, who's one of the leading CRISPR genetic engineering scientists, and we also talked to someone about kind of the future of meat and the idea of both protein-based meat that you're seeing and come to market already in like the Beyond Burgers and the Impossible Burgers, but also animal protein-based meat that's not grown with a cow or with a chicken or with fish. And I think as we get into those conversations, it starts to become about how we sustain our planet and our population and our food in the future, and that we need something that's more sustainable, and we need something that's more economical and something that can scale with greenhouse gases and with climate change and be better for the environment while still meeting our nutritional needs. So I think, you know, if you look at the livestock industry and its environmental impact, and you look at climate change and what that's doing to both where and the kind of crops we can grow, you see that there's probably definitely a need for these kind of technologies and these kind of explorations in order to be able to feed ourselves as we go forward.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. And I know that at least the publicity about some of those meats that you were talking about grown in a lab on a petri dish are not very appealing when we look at them. But I think what might be in play here is we're all going to have to sort of rethink the way we eat as the future comes on us, aren't we?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of things that we do at the moment are not necessarily sustainable going forward. in terms of the quantity of meat, for instance, we eat, or where and when we're able to grow crops, something's got to give. And I think some of these technologies will be able to help that, which is a great thing for the future.
What, in looking at this quarterly report, this newest quarterly report jumps out at you. What were there any other surprises? Were there any other things that you want to get across to folks?
Well, one of the opening interviews we do is with Rick Bayless, and he wanted us to help him bust a myth. And he came to us and he said, you know, I don't think it's possible that my friends are the only people who still eat dinner together around a table. He's like, and I keep hearing this myth that nobody has time to eat together anymore and nobody sits down at their table together anymore. And so we put the question in the field, and you know, the Ipsos survey results came back, and it turns out that it's true. Like, the myth is just a myth. There is still a great deal of people, nearly 84% actually, who still eat together at least three times a week with friends and family, at least among households that have two people that could eat together. And so I think that that notion that we still have food as a place where we come together and it's still a big part of our culture and our values that we eat together as friends and family, I think that was a really interesting finding in the survey data, and I think it was led to a really interesting conversation with Rick Bayless.
And people, again, can find this at jan-pop.com. Matt, this is wonderful stuff. I always enjoy reading this because it is, makes you think. It's very well put together, and we appreciate you being on with us this morning to share some of it with us.
Yeah, thanks. These are great and a lot of fun to put together, and I'm glad to be able to talk about it with you.
Matt Carmichael, editor at GenPop. Ipsos, powered by Ipsos, again, at gen-pop.com. We'll link out to the latest on the future of food. It's 5:30. This is The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Hi, this is Jim Dahlke, senior editor at Chicago Inno, with today's Inno Minute on WGN Radio. A rundown of all the Chicago innovation and tech news you need to know. Chicago eye care startup Opternative is changing its name as it aims to better convey its business-to-business offerings to the optometry and eyewear industries. The company, which now goes by Visibly, lets you take an eye exam from your phone at home and get contacts prescriptions refilled online. The startup has raised $18 million to date. And Chicago Inno just released our annual Startups to Watch list. It's a list of the 19 startups to watch in 2019, and you'll find consumer startups and B2B platforms, hardware makers and software solutions, and celebrity messaging apps and migraine-fighting nasal spray. Check out the full list at chicagoinno.com. That's today's Inno Minute from WGN Radio. Learn more at chicagoinno.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Wednesday edition of The Opening Bell. Our focus turning now to preserving Chicago's architectural integrity. And joining us this morning is the CEO of Klein and Hoffman, John Boyd, to talk more about this. John, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
Good morning, Steve. Nice to be with you.
And congratulations, too, on 65 years, 65th anniversary. Wonderful celebration, I hear.
Yeah, we've had an interesting run over the last 65 years. I haven't been there that long, but it's been a great tradition. But one of the things that we see in the architecture business, and especially what we do in the preservation and rehabilitation business, is you have to keep evolving, and that's been the really exciting thing over the last decade or so.
Klein and Hoffman, wonderful architectural firm, structural engineers on hand, inspectors. You are sort of one-stop shopping in this area. Also, Crane's one of Crane's top 100 places to work in Chicago. What's the secret to your success?
Well, you know, it was really humbling to be considered in the top 100 with Cranes, and interestingly enough, even more than that, a top 10 place for boomers. And when I heard them tell me that, I was a little bit taken back. I said, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Because I'm one of the boomers. But what I find is, you know, as a boomer, it's a great place to work because we get to work with these young people that are so enthusiastic about the work they do, and they want to save the planet. And, you know, we have a lot of millennials. We have a very varied workforce, and, you know, it just keeps the place fun.
Is this, we're talking about preserving sort of the architectural integrity of the city and some of the great buildings that are here. Is that, I don't want to call it a trend, but is that what's happening now in your business, where instead of coming in and removing buildings and just starting something fresh, that the trend is to maintain some of these older buildings and maybe rebuild them for the future?
Absolutely. In fact, that's where a lot of our focus is. We've been in the preservation market for a long time, starting back as early as the 80s, and we've worked on a number of really high-profile buildings in the city. I've had a long relationship with the Board of Trade Building. We've got over 30 years with the Shedd Aquarium Complex. More recently, we're working on the Union Station Complex and the renovation that's going on over there. And currently even on the Tribune Tower there. So, I mean, it's you know, when you talk about historic structures, that's one avenue. But preserving other buildings, in the earlier segment you talked about sustainability, and that's one of the things, the buzzwords in architecture these days, and one of the most sustainable ways to keep architecture moving forward is to reinvent old buildings. And we have a lot of our energies tied in that space, where we help design architects put new skins on buildings, maybe new exterior walls, and there's a lot of other things that are exciting in the architecture and engineering space moving forward that we think is really pointing in a new way that the millennial speaking and the younger people are really looking at it.
John, is that something driven by the client? Does the client say, we want to preserve this building? Or is this something that you put forward to the client and say, you know what, I think we can change this building and update it and keep some of its historic nature? Or is it a co-working sort of thing?
It's really both. I mean, a lot of our clients really have a passion for the buildings that they have and want to maintain a landmark. But other buildings that you don't really consider landmarks are very good, meaningful resources, and savvy owners, savvy business developers can look at a property like that and know that they can transform it into something new. One of the buzzwords we use a lot is adaptive reuse and repositioning of buildings, where you might take an old factory building and turn it into a commercial space or into a residential space. And that's been very common for a number of years in the city. And we see it being a really busy marketplace into the future. And, you know, as an architectural and engineering firm, we're somewhat unique in that we don't really do new design from the ground up. We really champion being in the space that we are with existing buildings predominantly.
Whenever I drive across the city, around the city, I always look at the skyline, and it always takes my breath away. We live in one of the most beautiful cities in the country, if not the world. When you look at the skyline, what do you see in Chicago?
Potential. Very simply put, potential. There's a lot of beautiful buildings in the city. But as buildings age, they're exposed to a lot of harsh weather. You know, buildings are much like the human body. You got to keep up with it. You got to take your medicine now and then. There's a lot of buildings that can be under-maintained, and those can be challenges. I think there's a lot of good stock in the city that can really be saved and made better. And interestingly enough, you know, in the city, you see a lot of tower cranes, you see a lot of new construction going on. But in fact, many of the buildings that we focus on in our practice in doing problem solving, unfortunately, is with buildings that are really not that old that have problems. And so what we have tried to do in our practice also is to take that experience and help design architects make better decisions in brand new buildings.
We, in that first segment you referenced, we were talking about the future, and it seems in whether you look at television or movies, whenever they show a city in the future, it's always sort of the same sort of shiny, nondescript, futuristic-type buildings. I get the feeling that at least here in Chicago, that's not going to be the case, that we're always going to have that sort of that character of our downtown. How do you view the future of buildings and the future of cities in that regard?
Well, there's no question that, you know, cities are going to evolve over time, but I would find it a shame if we lose the kind of heritage we have in the city of Chicago. You know, the architects that created and championed the buildings in the city, whether it was Burnham or the Halliburton Root and all of the famous architects, Sullivan to Wright, and even the more modern architects, if you look at the Getches and the VOAs and the SOMs that create these wonderful buildings, you know, they're archetypes and they're beautiful, they're a symbol of the city, and I think it would be a real shame to lose them. And I think there's a sense in most cities that you're going to save that type of architecture.
You mentioned earlier that your place is a good place for boomers to work. I know millennials, attracting millennials into the business is a big priority and in some cases a challenge. How are you doing that, and where do you look for the next generation of engineers and architects at Klein Hoffman?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We just simply look for the best candidates, and we find, obviously, in the architecture business specifically, it's a lean market. The architecture schools don't graduate as many young architects as they used to, and it is a challenge. But what we find is that the way the millennials are thinking today is very different than the way I did, for instance, when I got out of architecture school. They tend to be more idealistic. They do things differently. They think differently. But that's a real plus, I believe, in our practice. And we've had to reinvent our culture within the firm in order to deal with those sorts of issues. They may not work a classic 7-to-5 kind of day that we did. But they time shift, and getting used to that for somebody like myself is a bit of a challenge. But, you know, I'll see that one of my young engineers or architects will send me an email of a report that's been finished, and it's 11 o'clock at night. You know, it's just a different way of thinking, and we champion that. We support that, and it's just a matter of, you know, some of us old geezers having to think differently and embrace that kind of thing. And the other part is, you know, really championing a work-life balance. I know in my early career, we didn't have that nearly as much, and I think it's important.
I know you're still celebrating the current 65th anniversary, but have you had an opportunity to think about the next 65 years and what you, maybe at least the next 10 years or the 20 years coming, how you would like to see your firm interacting with the city of Chicago?
We've actually been very involved interacting with the city, especially in the building department. A number of our employees and leaders are involved with the new code changes that are in process. In fact, right now, over the next several months, there's a major push in revising and modernizing the Chicago building code. We're very much involved in that. I myself have been very much involved in the safety inspections and working with the City of Chicago Department of Buildings and the development of facade inspection ordinances for safety reasons and things like that. So we've had a very close relationship with the city for a number of years.
Well, it's wonderful talking to you, and thank you, John, for being on the program this morning. Please come back and spend some more time with us and talk more about buildings with us.
Absolutely. Love to do it. Thanks,
right.
Steve.
John Boyd, the CEO of Klein & Hoffman in Chicago. You can find them online at kleinandhoffman.com and even follow them on Twitter at Klein & Hoffman.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward opening gains on Wall Street. At The Opening Bell, Dow futures are up more than 0.5%. NASDAQ futures pushing nearly 1% higher, and S&P futures nearly 0.75% higher. Now, agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Well, we're halfway home on the Farm Bill. Yesterday, the Senate approved the Farm Bill compromise that avoids cuts in food stamps. That was one of the items that President Trump really wanted. And the lawmakers reached an agreement on a farm bill that leaves out the proposal to tighten food stamp criteria, backed by President Trump, offers some financial certainty to farmers suffering from the U.S. trade war with China. The bill passed the Senate 87-13, and now on Thursday, the House will take up the bill, and hopefully we'll have it on the president's desk by Friday. Taking a look at markets during the day yesterday, live cattle futures gained about 1%, lifted by technical buying and optimism for the continued strong demand for cattle and beef. Lean hog futures were mostly lower, weighed down by abundant hog supplies and by weaker cash prices. You have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Wednesday, December the 12th. The Consumer Price Index for November leads off today's economic reports. Analysts see no change in the rate of inflation from October. They're predicting a 2.2% pickup over last year. The Treasury statement for November is due this afternoon. Experts forecast a deficit of $165 billion. Also today, the Mortgage Bankers Association has the weekly mortgage applications, and the EIA Petroleum Status Report is due out on the earnings front today. Tailored Brands will release earnings after the close on Wall Street. Just some of the things that could move the markets on this Wednesday, December the 12th.